Well, I invite you to turn in your Bibles to the book of Ruth. If you're not familiar with where that is located, it is right between Judges and the books of Samuel. So again, I want to just thank you all for giving Amber and I an opportunity to celebrate our anniversary and spend some time away. Very grateful for that, very refreshing for us to be able to see some aspects of God's creation that we can only see through pictures or videos, but to really experience it firsthand and also to experience a very different culture than our own. That was eye-opening in a lot of different ways. And we're both kind of in agreement that if we ever decide to send missionaries to the Maldives, then we would sign up for that. So we'll see if that ever transpires. So we're going to begin a new series on the book of Ruth. We spent a lot of time in Matthew last year finishing up that long series. And then at the beginning of this year, looking at the book of Habakkuk, which we'll see that there are some parallels between Habakkuk and the book of Ruth. But I think that the perspective on those parallels in the book of Ruth is a little bit more, it's a little softer, it's a little more gentle. So when we look at the providential hand of God in Habakkuk, we can see that this is, in a way, it's a very severe providence in Habakkuk, something that Habakkuk himself didn't really like, but still Habakkuk was forced to trust God, to trust this God that he may not agree with, he may not understand, but to see ultimately that God is accomplishing his purposes. And when we see some of those same themes in the book of Ruth, it's a little bit, I guess we could say, more positive, at least for the most part. There's still a little bit of darkness in Ruth, and we'll look at that when we begin opening up the book in just a few moments. So the plan is to spend about 5 or 6 weeks in Ruth. It's a short book. It's only 4 chapters. It's a really probably well-known story, something that you're probably all very familiar with. I wouldn't necessarily call it a love story, even though, you know, maybe some of the teenage girls that are here would kind of see it that way. It is a love story in one sense, that it does demonstrate God's covenantal love, his mercy and his faithfulness and his goodness towards his people, his kindness. And of course, there's other aspects of that when we look at the characters in the book. And then after, that kind of brings us up until Easter, or thereabouts. And then after Easter, we'll probably begin a series looking at some of the roles and responsibilities of elders. So it would be something for us, Lord willing, if we could move towards having a plurality of elders this year. And it would be helpful for us, I think, to look at some of those passages that instruct us on what those elders are there for, what their responsibilities are, is what should they be carrying out as we consider having more than one elder. So that's kind of what you can expect in the next couple months. So if you're familiar with Margaret Atwood's novel, The Handmaid's Tale, now made into a hit Hulu show by the same name, you know the story of a dystopian future, the story of a tyrannical government, the so-called Sons of Jacob overthrowing the United States and establishing what they call their own republic, the Republic of Gilead. You're familiar with that once they accomplished this overthrow of the government and they established their own government, that they seek to eliminate any threats to their rule and any threats to their power, and they begin to restructure society, like all dystopian novels seem to do. And the people most affected by this restructuring are the women. They are relegated to the lowest position in society. They are forbidden to own property, to learn how to read or write. And then the women are further divided up into different groups based on their ability to reproduce. That's something that is made much more difficult by some sort of environmental crisis. Maybe she was alluding to East Palestine, Ohio, I don't really know. But there seemed to be only a number of women who could reproduce, and then those women were forced, I guess would be a way to say it, indoctrinated to receive training on how to carry out the will of their commander, to whom they had been assigned to bear his children and to carry on, carry out, and carry his seed. So the story revolves around this one character named Offred, her name being derived from the alleged name of her commander. She is of Fred, and her relationship with her commander. A very dark, disturbing story. Haven't read the book, but of course, many women our day see this, along with Margaret Atwood herself, as being what they're now experiencing with the overturning of Roe versus Wade. This is the future that she imagined when she wrote the book 35 years ago, or whatever it might be. Now, I was tempted to entitle the series on the book of Ruth, The Real Handmaid's Tale, because there are obviously a lot of allusions to the story, but in Atwood's mind, this is a very negative planning. We have, let's see, death and remarriage. We see a kinsman redeemer and a betrothal, and we see more children, all for the purpose of carrying on the name of the dead, all for carrying on the name of Elimelech. His family was faced with a crisis, and Ruth actually provides an opportunity for that family name to continue, for her, for that lineage to go on and on. I think there's obviously reasons why we can look at it as a tale, and we can look at it about a tale as a handmaid. Ruth herself is described as a maidservant or a handmaid. It's really interesting to see some of these parallels, and what Atwood, I think, understands is she understands kind of the abuse and how would you describe it? The disturbing nature of some of the patriarchal practices that, according to our perspective and our culture, we would look at in disgust. And I think she probably misses out on the book of Ruth because she doesn't really understand. It doesn't necessarily fit the message that she wants to share. It doesn't fit her understanding of somehow, in some ways, this being a very clear example of God's goodness and his kindness, and holding up several characters within the book of Ruth as examples of covenantal faithfulness. So the reason why I considered naming it The Real Handmaid's Tale is because this actually tells a true story that actually demonstrates a lot of important and key biblical themes. This is not a story about exclusion and strict societal order. The book of Ruth is a story about an obscure outsider, a Moabite, and how she gets welcomed into the family of God, into the people of God, and she actually gets welcomed by Yahweh himself. So this is not a story about oppression and subjugation. The story of Ruth shows us something that's much better. It shows us deliverance. It shows us and gives us an example of redemption. It is not a story about cruelty and simply demanding service. Ruth emphasizes something completely different. It emphasizes personal kindness, a loyalty that is bound, that binds itself into personal relationships. Very beautiful picture of that. And Atwood would focus on what corrupt men do when they have power. Ruth shows us what God does among his people, even during a time in which they are not necessarily the most faithful. So what we see here then is a very different trajectory and plot than Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale. The book focuses, as you well are probably aware of, on three main characters: Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz. So to give you kind of an understanding, to sketch out the book for you, let me just simply describe it for you in a few words here. The story follows Naomi and her family as they leave the land of Judah and travel to the land of Moab. There she is widowed, and then sometime later her sons die as well. She is left with no husband, children, or grandchildren, just with her two daughters-in-law, Orpah and Ruth. She decides to head back to Judah, after losing everything, and is accompanied by one daughter-in-law, Ruth, after attempting to dissuade both of them from going with her. Once they are back in Judah, the story focuses on Ruth and her chance encounter with Boaz as she gleans in his fields. Now, as it turns out, Boaz is a relative of Naomi's, and a plan is concocted by Naomi to see if Boaz will exercise his rights to redeem Ruth and perpetuate the name of her deceased husband. Now, more drama is added into the story with Boaz's recognition of another redeemer, one who was in closer relations to Naomi, but this unnamed redeemer decides not to act on his responsibility, so it is left to Boaz, and he gladly does the honorable thing and redeems the house of Elimelech and Ruth. Now, after the marriage of Boaz and Ruth, Ruth conceives and gives birth to a son. The name of her son is Obed, and he continues the family line of Elimelech and becomes the grandfather of David. Now, that's where the book ends. It ends on that very point. It ends, you know, with the genealogy after an epilogue of sorts. Not the most exciting way to end a story, nor is it the most exciting way to begin a story, but we see both of those happening in Scripture all the time. So, it's important to understand this. Look at the end of the book of Ruth. Now, these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nahshon. Nahshon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered David. Now, this actually tells us some really important things, and we shouldn't just be bored by a genealogy, though I understand the boredom. Notice that Obed is born number 7 in the line from Perez, and David is born number 10. So what we have here is we have a clear allusion to the importance of these characters, building up off that numerology that was so accustomed in Hebrew times. But it also tells us this clearly some important facts. When was Ruth written? Well, it was written sometime after David was born, right? Unless we want to insist that that genealogy was actually tacked on to Ruth after it had been written, I think it's probably best to see that it was written all together at once, the same author. And it shows us kind of the whole point of Ruth. This is a bridge between the time of the judges, in which there was no king, and the time of, well, the time of Samuel, the time of Saul, and the time of David. So most likely Ruth was written after the time of David in a way to demonstrate David's unique kinship. He also was from Bethlehem. He became the great king of Jerusalem, the king of Zion, the king of the people of God. Now, there are going to be two points that we want to make with this, to see it, first of all, as a bridge between Judges and Samuel, but also when we see where the Hebrew Bible puts it, we see Ruth as being an example of the godly woman of Proverbs 31. If you look at the Hebrew order of the books of the Bible, you see that Ruth is actually placed right after Proverbs. So when you conclude Proverbs and you read Proverbs 31, the next book you would read in order would be the book of Ruth. Now, that's not just one important point to make, because it is not just tied together canonically in the order of books in the Bible, but it's actually tied together thematically. So when Proverbs describes the godly woman, the only other place that word is used is in the book of Ruth, in describing Ruth in Ruth chapter 3. We'll see more about that when we get to chapter 3. Now, we go back to this bridge between Judges and Samuel. Now, why is that important? It's because the book of Judges makes it clear that the problem with the judges, the problem during that period of time in Israel's history, was that there was no king. Now, to give you 4 examples of this, at the end of the book of Judges, it occurs in Judges 17, verse 6, it occurs in Judges 18, verse 1, 19, verse 1, and then the very last verse in the book of Judges, which all you have to do is just look to the left in your Bible. And you can see what that verse says. Judges 21:25. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So it's almost as if, and if Samuel wrote Judges, and if Samuel wrote Ruth, and you know, perhaps that was that's an option. I don't know. I think Samuel died before before David died. Maybe he wrote it before that. I'm not really sure. But what point is being made? Well, Israel needs a king. Israel needs a ruler. And even though the ruler that they're going to ask God to provide for them in Samuel is not the ideal ruler, and the motivations for providing that king is not the ideal motivations, right? They want a king so they can be like the other nations. Well, look at all these other nations around us. They have a ruler. They have a king. Why can't we be like them? And God realized that in their request, they were actually rejecting God's rule from over them, which is a very interesting concept too, because when we look at this first character that we're introduced in the book of Ruth, Elimelech, what does Elimelech mean? It means my God is king. So there's this clear kind of interplay taking place between the Israelites' desire for a king, the reality that there is no king, and this provision of a king, according to the book of Ruth, according to what transpires through the events that are recorded in the book of Ruth. This is how we get the Davidic king. This is how we get the solution to the problem that's being experienced by the judges. Right? Of course, this is how God is going to work during this time to provide a king for his people, to provide a righteous ruler for his people, to provide a deliverer. This is how God is going to do it. He's going to do it through these four chapters in the book of Ruth. Now, second here, what we should see is that this is maybe even a little bit more astonishing. Of course, it probably was even more astonishing to the people of Israel during this time. But Ruth shows us that David was at least an eighth Moabite, an eighth Moabitean. I don't know exactly how you would say that, but you could say that David had Moabite blood in his veins. Now, that's really important for us to understand. Not a true, pure Israelite. There's a Gentile in there. A Moabite woman, a Moabitess, gave birth to his grandfather. Now, why is that significant? Well, it's significant not because she's included in his genealogy. Like that doesn't actually get mentioned in Ruth. There's another place that it gets mentioned, which we'll look at. But it's significant because these were people who were not included in the people of Israel. If you remember, the curse upon the Moabites was that they were not allowed to be involved or to be gathered into the assembly to the 10th generation. All right? We'll look at examples of that in Numbers and in Deuteronomy, but they were prohibited from being among the people of God. And what happens? Ruth becomes an Israelite. She gets grafted in. She, you know, has a conversion experience, or whatever you might call it. She clings to Naomi, and she becomes, actually, in the book of Ruth itself, she becomes an example of what a true Israelite looks like. And yet, she's a foreigner. She's a stranger. She's a Gentile. You know, it is significant enough to actually name the book after her. It probably would be more proper to call the book Naomi than it would be to call it Ruth. And yet, that's what the book is called. I said there's another place she gets mentioned, and that's actually in the genealogy of Jesus. So even though when we read the end of the book and we see the genealogy there, it doesn't mention Ruth. Boaz fathers Obed. And when you read the book of First Chronicles and the massive genealogy that's there in the beginning, you see the very same genealogy at the end of Ruth. Boaz fathered Obed. But when you get to the New Testament and you read the genealogy at the beginning of Matthew's Gospel, what does it say? Boaz, the father of Obed, by Ruth. Now, that was a scribal error. Right? There's a Moabite in Jesus' genealogy. Well, that shouldn't be there. She shouldn't be there. But it's extraordinary because if Matthew was simply rehearsing the genealogies that have been passed on from generation to generation, the one at the end of Ruth, the one at the beginning of 1 Chronicles, then he would not have included Ruth. This is the only other place she's mentioned in the Bible outside of the book of Ruth. So it shows that he is aware of the events of Ruth, and he deliberately adds her into Jesus' genealogy. Now, not just to be like an asterisk in his genealogy, or not just to be kind of a dark mark in his genealogy, but to demonstrate a very important point. Yes, she was the great-grandmother of David, but she was also the great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother of the Lord Jesus Christ, the true seed of Abraham, the seed of David. Here is the true king, the king of the Israelites, the king of the Gentiles, the king of the nations. There happens to be other women involved in there too, and all of those women in Jesus' genealogy are pagans. Tamar, who will actually show up in the book of Ruth, and Rahab, and the wife of Uriah, Bathsheba. So all of this is actually extremely important for understanding how the biblical narrative is moving. You know, we look at the Israelites and we think that they were just this consolidated whole and nobody entered into it or nobody exited out of it. And yet, there are all of these women specifically who actually join into the people of God. They are grafted in. They become a partaker of the inheritance and a partaker of the promises. And all of that is intended to show us ultimately what Jesus accomplishes. He's the God of all people, the King of the whole world. So that is kind of where Ruth is going to lead us. And maybe that's a bit of a spoiler alert thing. Maybe we shouldn't have gone too much into that. But we need to understand at least a part of the point, the intention of the book. Now, there are actually a few more reasons for studying the book of Ruth. I just want to mention these, to have you keep them in mind as we go through it. We'll touch upon them as we encounter them in the text. But it's important for us to kind of grasp some of these major themes. Ruth shows us the providential kindness of God as he works out his purposes in obscure people during a very dark period in Israel's history. Now, we got a glimpse of that when we read from Judges. Not a good time. Not a good time to live. Not a good time to be in the land. Because it seems like there's idolatry and there's surrounding nations that are violent. There is apostasy. All of those different types of things. And God's hand is very clearly at work in those events. So it's clear when you actually read Judges 2 and 3, you can actually see that the narrator is ascribing to God these ideas. God is giving up his people, he's turning from them, and then he's answering the response and he's raising up a judge. And he's being with the judge and he's doing these types of things to bring about a change among his people. And yet, during this time, as we'll see, during the book of Ruth, you see God act in a very different type of way. You see God actually showing favor and showing kindness and showing mercy. And it's very obscure, right? It's not as if God himself is speaking in the book of Ruth. In fact, he doesn't speak in the book of Ruth at all. There is no word from the Lord in the book of Ruth. And yet, his mysterious, providential goodness is being worked out. He's accomplishing his purposes. He's doing so in this dark time when the people have gone astray and there's murderous plots and there's idolatry and all those types of things. Yet God is working not through a king, not through a judge, not through a priest, not through a prophet. He's working in a bunch of farmers. he's working in the lives of a widow and the lives of, I guess, a couple of widows. So God is accomplishing his purpose in just these ordinary people who are going about their lives in just an ordinary fashion. I think that's encouraging for us to keep in mind, because much of our lives is filled with ordinary. Not a lot of sensationalism. You know, regardless of what's actually happening in Asbury, we're not there, so it really doesn't affect us that much. Much of our lives is just filled with mundane tasks, responsibilities, going through the motions, and doing the dishes and laundry and those types of things. And yet, that is how we see God work in the book of Ruth. It just so happens that Ruth goes into the field that belongs to Boaz. And it just so happens while she's in the field belonging to Boaz that she encounters Boaz. So all of these things that could just appear to be a coincidence is actually God's hand at work. And we need to be mindful of that. That even though we do the mundane and the ordinary and there's not a whole lot going on, God is continuing to work out his purposes. He is still sovereignly in control. He is still demonstrating his kindness and his loyalty to his people. So that would be one example of what we can see in this. Second, Ruth shows us something about kindness. Now, we could just kind of be generic and say, yeah, kindness is a fruit of the Spirit, and we just need to be kind to people. And that is really not very helpful at all, right? I mean, we try to instill in our children the need to be kind to one another, to strangers. But this kindness is demonstrated through these personal relationships. They're actually bound up together. So there's a loyalty that is being displayed between Ruth and Naomi, between Ruth and Boaz and Naomi's family that actually demonstrates for us what kindness really looks like. It looks like personal loyalty. It looks like a loyal friendship. Not just simply being nice to one another, but actually pledging of yourself to one another. I'm demonstrating this loyalty and this kindness to you out of my desire to actually show true kindness. And it's those examples that help us to understand what God's kindness is like. Because in one way, they are simply mirroring what God's covenantal loyalty looks like. This is how God acts with his people, and these are examples of how his people embody that very aspect of God, his kind loyalty. So there's more about that we'll dig into when we see it later in chapter 1 and chapter 3. All right, I think we're ready to jump into Ruth. Sorry, that may be too long of an intro, but it kind of helped us to get into it a little bit, and we're only going to look at the first 5 verses. So we are simply going to jump into the story, and then we're going to hit a problem, and then we're not going to resolve it. All right, so that's what you can expect. You're going to leave with this unresolved tension, wondering what is going to happen now. So Ruth 1:1-5. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his 2 sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, and the names of his 2 sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her 2 sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. They lived there about 10 years. And both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the woman was left without her 2 sons and her husband. So there you have it. This introduces kind of the initial problem in the book. Naomi is left destitute, no husband, no sons, and no grandsons. She is a foreigner in a strange land. She is a sojourner. She is a resident alien in the land of Moab. She has no family. She has no means to support herself. She has no protection in that society. She is empty, as she'll call herself later on in chapter 1. And this is the initial problem in the book of Ruth. This is what we see happening, and it's really kind of interesting to me to see how this works itself out, but you kind of read the first two verses, and the author seems to be introducing you to these characters, and you're kind of under the assumption that these are going to be the main characters of the story, and then it finds out in verse 3 and verse 4 and verse 5, well, 75% of those characters are already killed off. Elimelech's dead, Mahlon's dead, Kilion's dead. You wonder, okay, is this George Martin writing this? Game of Thrones style, you know, killing off the main characters. Like, he's not afraid to do that. But it's actually important for us to see, because the only other time these three guys get picked up is at the end of the book, when their names are mentioned again. Elimelech shows up, and Mahlon and Kilion show up. And you wonder, how is it that these guys continue to live? They're dead. How is it the name of the dead gets passed on? How is it that the name of the dead gets inherited? How is it that the dead actually see life? Well, it's through the process of this kinsman redeemer. So really, just starting out, you can understand one of the themes that I didn't mention is that this actually demonstrates that Ruth is about a passage from death to life. These people are all killed off, and yet their name continues on. Their claim to the inheritance, that treasured possession that God had bestowed upon his people, gets passed on to the offspring that's provided through Ruth and her union with Boaz. So yes, they are killed off, and that does present us with a predicament, a problem for Naomi, something that is incredibly tragic. But that's not the end of the story. This is just the beginning. He's going to show us how actually the names of these men are carried on. So that is one of the problems. The death of Elimelech and the subsequent death of Mahlon and Kilion. But there is another conflict. There is another problem that's actually introduced to us in the very first verse. We see the setting. This takes place during the time when the judges ruled, something we've already mentioned. And there's something else that happens in the land of Judah. There is a famine in the land. When the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab. Now, there is a little element of irony here. If you're familiar with the word Bethlehem, you know that that word actually means house of bread. So there is a little bit of irony here when he says that there is a famine in the house of bread. There's a famine. There is no food in Bethlehem. And you have to ask yourself two important questions. First of all, why is there a famine? And second, why did Elimelech go to Moab? Now, what's important here is that the narrator doesn't actually tell us those things. Now, if you read Naomi's response later on in chapter 1, she is going to attribute the calamity that she experiences coming from the hand of God. God did this to me. God brought about this desolation, brought about this emptiness. But the narrator doesn't actually describe that. I think anyone actually in this context, reading this story, would know that a famine occurs only through the hand of God. Whether it's a result of a drought, or whether it's a pestilence, or whether it's some sort of other contaminant, locusts, God is the one who brings those things about. And the reason why God is the one who brings those things about is because those are what he promised to do when his people broke covenant with him, when they were unfaithful, or they were not loyal to the terms of the covenant that they agreed to. You go back and you read Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28, you have clear examples of this. Let me read you one example from Deuteronomy. The Lord will strike you with wasting disease and with fever, inflammation, and fiery heat, and with drought, and with blight, and with mildew. They shall pursue you until you perish. The heavens over your head shall be bronze. The earth under you shall be iron. The Lord will make the rain of your land powder, and from heaven dust shall come down on you until you are destroyed. The presence of the famine then would indicate to anybody who understands this context and understands the Pentateuch that God is the one who's bringing this about because of the people's unfaithfulness. So it's not just a natural occurrence, even though the narrator doesn't actually say that specifically. So then, why did Elimelech leave? Well, he doesn't say. Presumably, it's because there ain't no food in Bethlehem. There's nothing to eat in the house of bread. So he decides to go into exile. I'm going to leave the land of promise. I'm going to leave my inheritance. I'm going to leave my people. I'm going to leave my God. And I'm going to go to Moab. Now, you could look at this and you could kind of justify Elimelech's actions and say, well, wouldn't you do anything to feed your family? If you can't find a job here to provide for your family, then you would move anywhere you could find a job to provide for your family. If there is no food, if there is nothing in the supermarket or Costco or something like that, then you would go to a place where there is food. You would do whatever it takes to feed your family. So from a very natural reaction would be, yeah, Elimelech's doing the right thing. He can't support his family for whatever reason. Whether it's just Bethlehem or whether it's just the entire land of Judah, there's just nothing that they can grow. Perhaps it is a drought. There's no rain. The crops can't grow. He can't borrow food from anybody else or buy food from anybody else because they don't have food either. So he's going to go to the place where there is food. He can look out from Bethlehem over the Dead Sea to the mountains of Moab and see that they have food. So he's going to go there. He's going to go to the place where he can provide for his family. But I think, again, that this would always be perceived as being the wrong answer. How is it that you respond to God's covenantal curses? Well, let me tell you this. It's not by running away. However much that may be the natural response, when you sin and you're faced with the consequences of your actions, running away does not make it any better. I remember being a teenager and being grounded for a month. Worst possible punishment ever, right? Grounded for 30 days, which felt like 300 days, eternity. I said, well, I'm not going to suffer the consequences of my actions. I'm not going to suffer under that punishment. I'm going to run away. So I wrote a letter. I can say this because my parents aren't here. I wrote a letter to my parents and tell them I'm just going to run away and go live with my friend where I could do whatever I want. So I did. Wrote the letter. Had my friend pick me up because I couldn't drive. Went to live with him. And got a call from my dad sometime that afternoon, and he told me to go home. Like, no, I'm not going to go home. I'm running away. I'm not going to be grounded. But eventually, he persuaded me that I needed to go home, and I went home. And I suffered for 30 long days. Now, of course, that response is not the right response. And it's interesting to think about because the response, even according to King Solomon, who was perhaps no stranger to sin, even when he dedicated the temple, His prayer was that when the people see these things and they experience these things, his prayer is that God would grant them repentance. That God would open their eyes and that he would lead them to turn. Turn from your sin when these things happen. This is what God is shouting to you when these curses fall upon the land. You're idolatrous. You have forsaken me. You have abandoned me. You're not loyal to the covenant. You're mistreating the widows. There's injustice everywhere. God is saying to them, turn. Turn to me and I will forgive you and I will heal the land. I will reestablish righteousness in the land. And yet, they don't hear it. So they run away. So I think when we understand, anytime you leave the promised land, the land of your inheritance, and you abandon God, that's never going to be a good thing. But of course, there's many ways, and we can relate to Elimelech here, is because it just seems easier. It just seems easier to move my whole family to a foreign land than it is to actually look in the mirror and acknowledge my own responsibility for my actions and to confess my sins before God. Right? I say that because it doesn't seem easier. But it's so incredibly hard sometimes to actually do that. I remember watching some children, not my boys, of course, but some of the girls in our family. And you're confronting them with their sin, knowing that, hey, this is very clear. And you try to get them to actually admit that they're wrong and how they struggle so hard not to actually have to admit that. The little things that they do to say, you know, to fight against actually admitting that they committed a sin, or they sinned against a sibling or something like that. We do these things all the time. We could turn from one another. We could stop praying. We could stop reading the Bible. We could stop going to church. We can cut off our Christian friends. We could even move. All because we're unwilling to admit that we're sinners, and all because we're unwilling to face the consequences for our actions. But that is not the right response. And some would say Elimelech dies because of it. Now, I don't know about that, but some would say that the reason why he died, which is, again, not given to us in the context, is because he's turned his back on God. He's turned his back on God's people. He's turned his back on God's land. And he leads his family into the world. You go away from God's place. You go away from God's presence. You go away from God's goodness. Instead of turning from your sin, you just absorb yourself and lose yourself in more of it. You distract yourself in all these other different ways. So he leads his whole family further away from Yahweh. And it's there that he dies for some reason. We're not told. And that becomes the initial crisis for Naomi. Her husband is dead. So there is no provision and there is no protection. So understand this, he goes to Moab because there's food there, presumably. And as a result, he dies, and his wife is left without provision, a way to provide for herself and her family, and she's left without a protector. Something that probably would be very needed for a Israelite in the land of Moab. And if you go back and you read Judges, the rest of Judges chapter 3, you'll see that. Right? That's the story of Ehud, the left-handed assassin who goes in and kills Eglon, the fat Moabite king. So she then concocts a plan, presumably, to have her sons marry Moabite women. If you're not familiar with the history of Moabite women, this is not a good option. So you remember the story of Lot? And the story of Lot and his daughters is where we get Moabites from. So she thinks that now, if her husband's married these wives, she's going to have grandchildren, and that there will be a family for her, and they can provide for her. She apparently was too old to remarry, or perhaps there wasn't any suitors. And she was most likely, obviously she's away from the land, so there was no way for her to be redeemed by any of Elimelech's family. So her husbands marry two women, Orpah and Ruth. Now it is important to recognize the names of these two boys, Mahlon and Chilion. So there's a lot going on with the names of people in the story. Mahlon means sick or sickling, so you don't have much hope for him. And Chilion, some people take his name to mean pining or kind of fading away. Some see it as meaning annihilation. So there's not much hope for him either. Now you could kind of, you know, read into it a little bit and say, well, why would you name your kids sickling? Anyways, they marry Orpah and Ruth. Orpah means something about the top of the head or the back of the head. And actually, it's kind of interesting to see her response to Naomi later on in chapter 1 is that she turns her back on her. So she turns her back on her, Orpah. She Orpah's Naomi. And then Ruth means something like friendship, comfort, refreshment, something like that. And she's the one who clings to Naomi out of covenantal kindness. So we'll get more into that later on, but her two sons marry, and they live there about 10 years. So there is no plans to go back home. There's no plans to go back to Bethlehem. And then tragedy strikes again. Mahlon, sickling, and annihilation die. So that the woman, here Naomi is referred to at the end of verse 5, just as the woman, she's left without her two children and her husband. It's interesting. Let me just point something out to you. Here, two things. Naomi has lost everything. She's even lost her name. And she's lost her two children. The word there for sons in verse 5 of the ESV is not the same word that's used for sons in the first three verses. It's a different word. It's a word that actually means child. So the author is saying that she's lost her children, her two childs, which is interesting because the only other place that word shows up is at the end of the book when she is given another child, when she is given a grandchild, Obed. So there's clearly, again, another allusion to the end of the story. How is God going to work in the midst of this tragedy, this devastation, this destitution, this emptying of Naomi? How is God going to work to provide fullness and filling? How is he going to work to provide redemption? It ultimately won't happen until the child is born at the end of the book. So there you have it. That is kind of the opening instruction for us, this opening introduction to the book of Ruth. Ordinary people, perhaps reading into this, see that they have, in a way, made a series of bad choices. They've turned away from the living God. They've gone to live in a foreign land. And tragedy has struck. Naomi has lost her husband, and she's lost her children. She tries, actually, to lose her daughters-in-law as well. But there is, of course, grace in that. And that Ruth decides to bind herself to Naomi. So that is a little bit of a depressing look at the beginning of Ruth. It is challenging for us to dig into it because you do see God's hand. And this is not necessarily what you would expect when you see God at work. And yet, the very ways in which God begins to work back in Bethlehem jumps out at us in the beginning of verse 6. So as a segue into what you'll hear next week, what is it that the Lord does? The end of verse 6, the Lord visits his people and gives them food. So clearly then, what we're going to see is we're going to see God move in a much more positive way. That's going to draw these women back to Bethlehem. And there's going to be all of these chance encounters that take place that result in the one who would bring deliverance to his people. So let's pray.